Hi, everyone, and welcome to ABCs of Anesthesia. And today we have another live Viva session. And so, hey, Rebecca, how's it going? You're about to sit your exams?
Yeah, it's going well, I hope.
Yeah, yeah. When
you tell me.
What's the feedback you've got so far? What are you trying to work on at the moment?
At the moment, I'm trying to be a little bit more succinct with my main issues when I'm answering the questions. Sometimes I find that my mind is running ahead of what the next question might be, what the next issue might be, and then I don't listen so well to the question that is actually being asked. And then I fluff, and I fill the space with fluff sometimes. So I'm trying to rein that in a little bit.
I'm definitely guilty of that. Like, I feel like when your mind works at 100 miles an hour, like you're literally saying more. You know, part of me, except for not, I remember in my first part exam, just totally missing the question. I kept answering another question, and it was painstaking for the poor examiner. Luckily, I passed in the end. But yeah, it was just one of those moments where take a breath, pause. And yeah, we'll definitely, this particular Viva may have elements of that. So we'll see how we go. Why don't we start with the STEM? I'll put it up on the screen, and I'll also read it out to people who are listening on the podcast. Essentially, the full Viva will be on the final exam course, but you'll get most of this Viva without my feedback, just on YouTube. So let's start with this one. Okay, hopefully you can see a STEM there. Mm-hmm. And the STEM reads, you are asked to review your next patient, a 25-year-old, 130-kilogram transgender female, pronouns she, her, hers, for augmentation mammoplasty with implants and maybe lipofilling. She has a past history of asthma, anxiety, depression, obesity, 130 kilos, as we mentioned. She's 170 centimeters tall with a BMI of roughly 45. The medication she's on is Symbicort, salbutamol, venlafaxine, spironolactone, and oral estrogen. She has allergies to kiwi fruit, avocado, and also she has a whole body rash with penicillin. She's very concerned about the impact of her hormone treatment and anesthesia. What do you advise her? And I think I'll give everyone just about, yeah, let's go 2 minutes. You can pause here if you're watching, because I'll skip through the 2 minutes and make it only 5 seconds in the actual video. But let's get you started, starting now. And so, yeah, just start with, do you want to show everyone what you use that 2 minutes for? Maybe tell us a bit about how you approach that.
This is my page. And so what I've spent that 2 minutes doing is writing down the information that I've got from the Viva and then blocking it into patient. And this is where I sort of put pathology stuff, the procedure that they're having. Any professional issues. So I put autonomy here for her. She's probably going, like, autonomy and discussions are going to be important for her. And then the setting I normally put here, whether I'm pre-admission clinic or it's 2 a.m. and we're coming into ED. And then this is where I put what the actual question is. And I try to number the issues that I want to address.
Good. And did you write the answer to the question first before you do the other stuff, or did you do the other stuff first?
I put the question in the bottom right, and I do everything. I make sure that I read every line of the of the STEM. But what I was doing is I was starting at the bottom and then going back around. Then I was finding that I was running out of time.
So
I just read the whole thing through and put the question at the bottom. I've got the context for the question.
Did you answer the question in that bottom right before you started doing the other patient pathology?
Oh, yes. Before I started writing what I wanted to address in the bottom right before I started numbering the rest of the issues.
Cool. Can you show that up again to the screen? Okay, good. So you've got the estrogen and the spironolactone, and you've got essentially dot point answers there. I like that you've got the kiwi, so latex allergy. So you've got an association with that, antibiotics testing, perfect. And yeah, that all looks really good. Let's get cracking with the Viva. So Rebecca, candidate 1, 2, 3, do you understand the question?
Yes.
Excellent. She's very concerned about the impact of hormone treatment and anesthesia. What do you advise her?
So I'd like to thank her for being so engaged in her anesthesia, because that's not usual for my patients, and gives me a little bit of time to gain some rapport with her. And then I'd like to address any issues that she has, anticipating that she wants to discuss her estrogen therapy and her spironolactone anti-androgenic therapy. And I'd outline the concerns that I would have for her having that extra therapy under the anesthetic and the increased or the special risks that that comes with, and how we're going to address those special risks, and then talk to her about medication management perioperatively. And then I would go on to talk about the issues that I foresee for her given the rest of her medical history. And I'd also take some further history from her, specifically being concerned about if she's had previous airway feminization, like voice feminization surgery, laryngeal surgery. And then also outlining the other issues being her obesity, the tendency that she might have to be latex allergic or latex anaphylactic given her allergies to kiwi fruit and avocado, exploring a little bit more about antibiotic allergies that she may have given that history of the penicillin all over body rash, whether she's had any testing for that, and then go through a usual consent process with her.
Let's focus on the estrogen and the spironolactone. Let's say she hasn't had any voice-changing surgery. Actually, quickly, what are the different kinds of surgeries that transgender females may have to alter their voice?
So there can be a range of different surgical procedures to alter or feminize a woman's voice. Some of them actually cut into the thyroid cartilage and shorten the thyroid cartilage as well as shortening the vocal cords themselves. Some of them debulk the vocal cords. Others put tensioning wires through the anterior vocal cords, which can sometimes then regress.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. So let's say she hasn't had any voice changing operations or any kind of laryngeal operations. Tell me about estrogen and spironolactone's effects in anesthesia.
So the estrogen comes with a few different or a few extra considerations. So it increases the risk of venous thromboembolism. It is bound by Sugammadex. Withdrawals can occur when we withhold them perioperatively, which can manifest as irritability and mood changes. It decreases the activity of pseudocholinesterase, which may have a prolonging effect for neuromuscular blockade from succinylcholine. And it also decreases the concentration of circulating albumin, which is important for our highly protein-bound drugs.
Like what?
Like local anesthetics and propofol.
Which local anesthetics in particular?
Bupivacaine.
Is there any evidence for this being a problem?
We don't fully understand the extent of this issue. So we just have to have a lower threshold for considering local anesthetic systemic toxicity as part of our anesthetic care. There isn't evidence to support that there would be an increased rate of postoperative nausea and vomiting in transgender women, but I think it's something to consider, especially with anybody who is a non-smoker and otherwise a young female patient.
Okay. How about the venous thromboembolism risk? You said this increased. What is that risk? What are you going to do about it?
So for this patient especially, I'm concerned about her venous thromboembolism risk because this is a prolonged procedure and she's already an obese woman. So I would be using TEDS as well as Flotrons, and I would be having a discussion with the surgeon about whether we should give heparin preoperatively, which is often something that we do in our breast cancer patients. And so that would be a multidisciplinary discussion with our surgeon.
And are there any recent guidelines for this? Are there any recommendations about BT prophylaxis with estrogen therapy?
There probably are.
Yeah, well, good. How about spironolactone? What are you thinking there?
So spironolactone we know well in its use for advanced liver failure and as a diuretic medication. So we know that it increases the risk of acute kidney injury perioperatively, and and to avoid intraoperative hypotension, we would usually withhold it on the day of surgery. It also alters our electrolyte balance using that aldosterone pathway. So it is and it does increase the risk of hyperkalemia. And it also does put her at risk of having liver dysfunction. So I would want to see LFTs additionally, whereas if she was on a spironolactone, then I wouldn't be testing LFTs for this patient.
Okay, good. Let's say she's very happy with what you've said and sounds like there's a good plan for her operation. Well, what do you want to know? You mentioned a few other things already, but what, aside from what you've already mentioned, what do you want to know on assessment?
So I would take a usual anaesthetic history about previous anaesthetics that she had and ensure that she has no family history of scoline apnea or malignant hyperthermia, ask her about her previous operations, and it's good to know that she hasn't had any voice feminization surgery from my point of view, from an airway management point of view. I would examine her airway and inquire about her, if she's had any allergy testing, specifically around antibiotics, because I want to know if she is at risk of having anaphylaxis to my cephalosporin prophylactic antibiotics that I'm going to give her. And then we would have a discussion about performing regional anesthesia, as well as analgesia, the usual analgesia that I give her and the usual antiemetic prophylaxis that I give her. Yeah. And then I would advise her that I'd like her to withhold her spironolactone on the day of surgery.
What else do you want to know preoperatively?
I would also do a usual exercise tolerance assessment.
Yep, let's say exercise tolerance is fine. What concerns you specifically about the airway from what you know already?
Oh, sorry. I'd also inquire about whether she has risk factors for sleep apnea or if anybody has noticed that she apneas or snores through a closed door because of her obesity.
What are the other things that concern you about asthma and obesity in this patient?
So she is in class 3 obesity at this BMI, and her asthma symptoms are likely to be confounded by her obesity as well. So she can also have an obstructive and restrictive pattern to her breathing.
And tell me more about your asthma assessment.
So I would want to assess the severity of her asthma, whether she's previously been in the admitted to hospital or admitted to the intensive care unit, and also whether she's had any episodes recently of nighttime asthma, whether she has any known triggers such as anti-inflammatory medications, and whether she's needing to use her salbutamol frequently.
Anything else?
Any upper respiratory tract infections recently?
Let's say she did have a course of prednisolone 3 months ago with an upper respiratory tract infection. What else do you want to know?
Whether her symptoms are back at baseline, and what is her baseline.
Let's say she has no symptoms currently at all. What do you want to know about her obesity?
Whether she has any obstructive sleep apnea or any signs of obesity hyperventilation syndrome. So I would also preoperatively, ideally, I'd like to send an ABG, see what her CO2, her resting CO2 is, her awake resting CO2.
And so let's say this patient turns up to you onto your list, doesn't have any, has had no sleep studies, no investigations for OSA. Would you do an arterial gas in her before you get her off to sleep or?
No, I think I'd probably just send UECs and ask for her UECs because that would come back probably pretty quickly. And she may even have had renal function tests done recently, and that would have an awake bicarb.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what does that tell you?
That would tell me if she has an elevated PaCO2.
Yeah, okay. What's your anaesthetic plan for her for this mammoplasty?
So I would discuss with the surgeon about what their surgical requirements are, but I'm anticipating that this is going to be a long procedure and that it's going to be predominantly a supine procedure where they may need to break the bed to sit her up to check for asymmetry. Or for symmetry, rather. So I would perform a general anaesthetic using an endotracheal tube. I would have a BIS monitor for her and I would run Teva anaesthetic. I would give her a regional blockade at the start of the case to minimise the amount of opioids that I need to use throughout the procedure. And that's predominantly what I would do.
Yeah, okay. She's very concerned about pain post-op. So what would your pain plan be intraoperatively and post-operatively?
So for induction, I would use fentanyl and propofol and get her off to sleep using a non-depolarizing neuromuscular blocker, put down the endotracheal tube. And then what we do at our site is to use paravertebral blocks. But an alternative for her, given her obesity and the fact that I don't really want to have bilateral paravertebral blocks, would be a PEX 2 block, which would be performed with ultrasound.
Just quickly, have you ever done a bilateral paravertebral block, or is this only for unilateral breast surgery?
It's usually for unilateral breast surgery. So usually for bilateral, we wouldn't do bilateral paravertebrals.
And what would you do generally at your institution? It PEX 2 block, is that the standard or?
No, usually we just do the paravertebral on the side that's going to have a mastectomy. I'm sort of translating information across from cancer surgery, because I haven't done an augmentation mammo with implants and filling before.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I've definitely seen some studies or case reports where people have done bilateral paravertebrals, and one of my mates definitely has done that. But to go on, can you describe the pec block for me?
So the pecs one block is a fascial plane block where you put at least 10 mils of local anesthetic between the pec major and the pec minor muscle at the level of the second to third rib, using a linear probe, high frequency, 6 to 13 gigahertz, in a superior inferior alignment.
How do you place that probe if you were to show me on yourself?
So this is my handy dandy probe.
Yep, nice.
Place it here.
Okay.
So it's superior inferior. And then using your Sonoplex needle from the superior aspect of the probe, using an in-plane technique, and then introduce at least 10 mils in that space. Mm-hmm. And then you go on to do the PECS 2 aspect, which is a fascial plane block between the PECS minor muscle and the serratus anterior and the serratus muscle. You need to rotate the probe about 60 degrees, mm-hmm. and then translocate the probe over the third and fourth rib.
Okay. And what are you blocking with each block?
I use 0.2% ripivacaine because I can use a lot of volume, which is great for a fascial plane block. Mm-hmm.
0.2%. So what kind of volume are you giving with 0.2%?
So you can give 15 mils in each of those fascial planes for her. That so would be 60 mils, which is 120 milligrams.
Yeah, that's well below
the max.
How long does a 0.2% block last?
It depends. If you use additives, you can put some clonidine in there, or you can use dexamethasone, which can be given systemically, mm-hmm. and hopefully you can get that block out to 12 to 24 hours.
And why do you use 0.2% instead of just using 0.75 and 10 plus 10 mils of that, or 0.375 and up to 40 mils?
Our surgeons like to use a little bit of local with adrenaline to infiltrate into the planes. So that still gives them the wriggle room to be able to use some local anesthetic. And it's also, as from a safety point of view, I'm well below my max dose.
Okay. What nerves are you blocking?
I can do rescue blocks as well in recovery if I need to.
Okay. What nerves are you blocking with at each site?
So in the PECS 1 block, we're blocking the medial and lateral pectoral nerves. And then in the PECS 2 block, we're blocking intercostal nerves as well as intercostal brachial nerves.
Okay. Any other nerves in PECS 2?
I think we also can get the long thoracic nerve.
Okay. What area are you worried about not anesthetizing using this technique?
The medial aspect of the anterior chest wall. So if we needed to get to the medial aspect around the sternum, then we would need to do a parasternal block.
Any other areas that aren't potentially blocked?
I'm not sure.
What's the level here? What are we getting dermatome-wise?
We would not get as high as T1 up here.
Okay.
So to cover the more superior aspect of the chest wall, we would need to do a suprascapular block to get the suprascap nerve.
Is there another block that you're thinking of?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Now, let's say you do the induction. Your reg does the airway, does a reasonable job at it. It's a grade 2B view. And now your reg is managing the case. They're a junior reg, and you're happy that they're able to manage this case, and you're in the tier having your break. You're called in for decrease in sats. The sats are now 87% or 100% oxygen. You hear the ventilator alarming, and the surgeon has stopped, and your reg is trying to improve the situation, you know, with the bag in hand. At this point, what do you do?
I would probably ask. I would take over. I would put the ventilator across onto the APL valve and turn the APL valve up to 30. Confirm that I have an FiO2 of 100%, ask my reg and my tech to organize a suction catheter to pass down the tube. Mm-hmm. I would manually ventilate and feel the compliance of the bag in my hand.
At 30 of pressure, you get tightness and then it just collapses.
Okay. So I'm thinking that given the tightness of the bag, I'm thinking that I've got high airway pressures as well as hypoxemia. So now I'm thinking down the line of, Have we irritated her lungs? Has she got bronchospasm now? Is this an exacerbation of her asthma? I'd also quickly scan the circuit and make sure that there hasn't been a disconnect or there isn't part of the circuit under the wheel of the ventilator, for example. And then pass the suction catheter.
Let's say at this point, you haven't been able to ventilate a satisfactory volume. With 30 of pressure, you've got maybe 50 mils of tidal volume in, but the rest escapes. What do you do?
Turn the APL valve higher and see if I can get rise and fall of the chest and listen and see that there is equal air entry, that we're not endobronchial and that we don't have a pneumothorax.
Okay, you have equal.
See if that increased pressure is actually giving us any end tidal CO2.
You get a very small blip of end tidal CO2 and you hear very loud wheeze and about 100 mils of volume that you're able to get, but very tight circuit.
Okay, so now I'm going down the differential of high airway pressures and asthma or bronchospasm. I still want to pass that suction catheter to make sure that there's nothing plugging the tube. I think it's unlikely, but I'd like to do that and then organize for some salbutamol to attach to the circuit so that we can try to relax those airways.
Yeah, great. So you pass the suction catheter and you do get just a lot of mucus coming up. You connect the MDI to the circuit and what do you do then?
So now in coordination with my tech or my registrar, I'm going to give 6 to 12 puffs of salbutamol. I'm also going to turn the sevoflurane on because I know that sevoflurane is good for bronchodilation.
Mm-hmm. What percentage sevoflurane?
So I'm going to wash it in. So I'm going to have high fresh gas flows, turn it up to 8%, mm-hmm. keep an eye on my BIS and start down titrating my propofol at the same time.
As you turn it up, you see 0% on your monitor. Why is that?
Because we're still not ventilating her. So until we have her across onto the sevoflurane, we can't really turn that propofol off. So we just need to make sure that we don't end up with a completely isoelectric BIS. But be aware that at some stage we're going to have to get her across.
You put 6 to 12 puffs down and you manage to get some level of volume in, again, at very high pressures. So you get, say, 100 mils, 150 mils. The wheeze is still extremely loud. As you're trying to, you've got 100%, the sats are about 85%, and the CO2 has now climbed. We've got a very bronchospastic trace. The CO2 is about 70.
So we still have like very advanced bronchospasm here. Our next line is to get some ketamine out of the trolley and to get some magnesium out of the trolley. We've got some sevoflurane. We're trying to get some sevoflurane on. Mm-hmm. Given that my current management has been unsuccessful, I'd like a second pair of hands. So I'd ask the reg if they can call for the DA and I'd ask the nurses if they can get the ketamine out of the cupboard for me. I know that that's going to take a couple of minutes now.
Let's say it's the evening and your consultant's at home and everything is, they're 20 minutes away. So you've got a couple of registrars, two nurses and yourself.
Okay. Well, still, that's great. That's good. I've got at least a couple of extra pairs of hands. So that's good. So I get the most senior registrar to continue to try to give them some salbutamol. Mm-hmm. I'll get my more junior registrar to draw up the ketamine in 200 milligrams in 20 mils mm-hmm. and give 40 milligrams. Mm-hmm. I'd also ask them to draw up some magnesium and I'd ask them to titrate in the magnesium. I want them to give 20 millimoles over the next 20 minutes and for them to watch and manage the blood pressure at that time. Mm-hmm. And then the third task that I'm going to ask them to do is to look up the salbutamol intravenous dilution protocol or guideline that we have in our department because I can't remember it off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to start giving the salbutamol intravenously as we aren't currently ventilating the salbutamol in via the circuit.
Look, you get to you action all of these steps and you get to a place where sats are around 88% on 100% FI, still very severe bronchospasm noises, wheezes on auscultation, but you are able to get 200 mils of tidal volume in this patient, but with you're getting alarmings from the ventilator and your CO2 is now 100. What do you do?
So I'm still working down my algorithm and I'll get a second tech to open up the Borshoff book and make sure that we're not missing any steps. Yeah. I'm going to examine the patient and make sure that we don't have a pneumothorax, which might also be
pneumothorax
contributing to the difficulty in ventilating.
Okay. And the book is missing, so it's all on you.
Okay.
And you don't have an iPhone with you for Google.
Okay. And at this stage, I'd probably crack out some adrenaline and start infiltrating adrenaline 10 mics per mil just to try to help break the bronchospasm. I'm going to apologize to the surgeon. I'm saying, I'm sorry, this is not safe for you to continue at the moment. We're going to have to stabilize this patient before we can let you continue. I'm going to call the ICU consultant and ask about whether they have the capability of ECMO at this site.
Let's say you get to a place now where you're able to get 300 mils tidal volume. And the pressures are still very high to do that. And the CO2 is now 120, but your SATs are 90% now.
Okay. So I'm a little bit more relieved. I can take a breath now that the oxygenation has improved. She still is very hypercapnic. I'm not as worried about that as long as her pH is normal. So I send an ABG and see what the pH is.
Oh, the pH is very low, 7.1.
Okay. All right, I can't quite take as deep a breath as I was hoping then. So I still think that we need to withhold surgery until we can get on top of her gas exchange. And I still want to have that discussion with the ICU doctors about she needs to go to ICU intubated. And there's a possibility that we're going to need to get her on ECMO if she is to have any further exacerbations of her bronchospasm.
As you're leading the situation, you've got the registrar ventilating, and you notice that the blood pressure is dropping now. So the heart rate was 120, it's now 130. Your oxygenation is, as I've said, they're roughly bagging the patient at about 15 breaths per minute, and the blood pressure is now dropped from a stable 100 to 70.
Okay, so now I'm concerned that we have hemodynamic compromise, and that could be because of the very high intrathoracic pressures exerting a sort of obstructive shock picture, or it could be that she's blown a pneumothorax. Either way, the first thing I'm going to do is disconnect the ventilator, disconnect the circuit from the patient's tube, and ask the surgeons if they can help us decompress her chest, reconnect, see if that has alleviated the issue.
You get immediate resolution from that. So now the blood pressure's come back up. What do you dial on the ventilator?
So I'm going to put her onto a volume control ventilation mode.
Why volume control?
Because I have to choose one.
What's the best mode for volumes to get the most volume when you've got a severe bronchospasm?
So it depends on the ventilator that you have. On the Hamiltons, it's a little bit easier to use a volume control ventilation than on our anaesthetic machines. We have the ACES GE anaesthetic machines.
Let's say you've got an ACES GE because you're in theatre.
Okay, well, then I probably would dial up pressure control if I can get the pressure limits as high as I need to guarantee her volumes. I could use pressure control volume guarantee, which is the mode that I use most commonly. That allows me to dial up a volume. And
that's fine. Tell me the other parts that you're going to be dialing up.
I would put a respiratory rate of 8 with a very high IE ratio of 1 to 8. Mm-hmm. And I would start with 3 or 4 of PEEP to try to match her a little bit of intrathoracic pressure and splint some of those small airways open. Mm-hmm. If that doesn't work within the first 2 minutes, then I would turn it down to 0 PEEP. It's quite a dynamic situation. She's got very brittle asthma. So it's not a set and forget. It's a set and watch and out and tinker as you go. Okay. Our ventilators are not as good as the ICU ventilators, and they're not as good as the transport ventilators as well. So if I'm really struggling with our ventilator, I'd ask for the transport ventilator to come in and I'd put her straight on the transport ventilator.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Let's say you do this and you get to a level of safety for this patient, and the patient actually goes to ICU and recovers over the next day. So everything's kind of sorted. A few days later, the patient recovers, they're on the ward, but you receive a complaint that a tooth has been chipped. What do you do?
Well, I would, before going to see the patient, I'd probably discuss in my department with a trusted colleague who's come across this issue previously about what the pathways are in our department, and if there's any issues that they have come up against it when they have had to pursue this pathway with a patient. Mm-hmm. And then I would go to the patient perform an open sort of disclosure recounting of the events that happened, acknowledge the injury that has happened, and then give her information and options about how she wants to progress this. We're lucky at our institution that we have dental services available through the public health system which is based for our state at our institution. So I would give her information about the referral pathway, write a referral for her. And I'd also give her information about the complaints pathway at our hospital and say that she doesn't have to, I'm anticipating that she may want to make a formal complaint. She can make that at any time. If she decides not to at this point in time, that avenue is always open. I'd also document all of the case for myself, as I would have considering that this was there was a critical event in theatre, and also document about her dental injury and keep a copy of my own records and discuss with my MDO and then put a referral in for our departmental M&M meeting for discussion of dental injury and also enter in a WebAS.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Any other place to report this for the hospital?
For the hospital, we have something called DATEC SIMS, which is a...
yeah, good. How do you take care of the tooth? Let's say the tooth has been completely dislodged. What would you do with that?
The physical tooth, if it comes out, needs to be put in milk. And then she needs to have a rather urgent referral if the tooth has completely been dislodged to see either the dental surgeons or the MaxFax surgeons. And so I think dental surgeons are at our institution twice a week, whereas MaxFax we can reach on a more urgent basis after hours included.
Excellent. Hey, Rekha, that's the end of the Viva. Well done. Hey, so we're going to, for the YouTube viewers, we're going to cut it there. And for the full discussion, it'll be on the final exam course and there'll be a link up, hopefully sent up on this video anyway. Let's go.
Thank you so much for listening to this anesthesia final exam case scenario. For the full episode with all the feedback and notes, please check out my final exam course at the link provided in the story notes. So thanks for listening, and please share with anyone who might be interested. See you next time.